Lecture 4, Camus, The Myth of Sisyphus.
In The Stranger, Camus gives us a character who is forced to reflect on his life, and ultimately reflect on the meaning of life. To put the conclusion rather bluntly, life is the meaning of life. It's not anything outside of life, and it's not even necessarily any particular content of life or way of life. It's just life itself. About the same time that Camus wrote The Stranger, he wrote a philosophical essay, which one might take as a theory that accompanies The Stranger and perhaps explains it. It's called The Myth of Sisyphus. And just to remind you, Sisyphus was a character in Greek mythology. He was condemned by the gods to a truly pointless task. He had to roll a rock up a mountain, and of course when it got to the top, it would roll down of its own weight, and he would have to do it again, and again, and again, and again. This is a kind of symbol of what Camus refers to famously as the absurd. And he points out in his retelling of the story of Sisyphus that one can't think of anything more absurd than a lifetime filled with futile labor. Now, the notion of the absurd is a special notion. It's not particularly technical, but it's important to distinguish it from many of the absurdities we find in life. Silly things happen, ridiculous things happen. One thinks, for example, of a Three Stooges short. But that's not the absurd. The absurd, which Camus says has overtaken modern sensibilities, which is really a kind of obsession with the way we see the world today. The absurd is really a metaphysical thesis. It's, to put it very bluntly, it's a confrontation. It's a confrontation between the rational human mind, the mind that deserves and demands justice, that expects the universe to be comprehensible, and what Camus calls, in a phrase that he borrows straight from The Stranger, an indifferent universe. The truth is, the world doesn't care. Now, you might say that it's part of our human nature, not something we learn from society, but part of our nature itself, that we care about each other, that, as many philosophers have argued, we're born with a sense of compassion or sympathy or pity. And perhaps we're even born with a sense of justice, some sense of fairness, even in small children when they're not treated as they would like to be treated. Without having a choice in the matter, we project this sense on the universe, and we expect the universe to fulfill our demands. We think, for example, that evil should be punished. We think that goodness should be rewarded. And the problem that goes all the way back to the early Middle Ages, often called the problem of evil, the obvious fact that virtue is not always rewarded, the obvious fact that the evil sometimes get away with what they do, has always been a deep problem for theological thinkers, but without even reference to religion. It's a problem for all of us. The absurd is this recognition that we have a demand of the world, and the world just doesn't care. Now, in The Stranger, interestingly, Merceau accepts this. When he opens his heart to the universe and says, it feels so brotherly, what he's saying is that the universe itself is indifferent. It just is what it is. And he himself has always been, and now on reflection, simply is who he is, and he accepts that. Now, there's a sense in which, you might say, the absurd would cease to be a problem if we believe in God. Camus, of course, is an atheist. But the truth is that the absurd would exist even if there's a God. In fact, the problem of evil, as it goes back through history, is very much a problem in the face of God, that we have these expectations and the world doesn't seem to deliver. At one point, Camus says, even if there were a God, it wouldn't matter. Now, in The Stranger, it's often said, and Meursault says, that it's death that makes life absurd. There's a long soliloquy where he considers his death penalty and the ways in which it might be less absurd, for example, if they gave him a 1 in a million chance to escape. But the idea that death makes life absurd, which of course is an ancient view that goes all the way back to the Greeks, is countermanded by the story of Sisyphus himself. Sisyphus is immortal. What makes his life absurd is the fact that he is condemned to a lifetime of futility. But if that lifetime of futility, in fact, is an immortal lifetime, going on for all eternity, I think we would agree that that makes it not less absurd, but rather more absurd. One might say that it's a kind of blessing in life that we don't get a chance to get totally bored. And there have been several interesting attempts to draw sketches of immortality in which the almost inevitable outcome is, at a certain point, boredom, futility, a sense that it's just the same thing over and over again, a thesis that we'll see come again when we talk about Nietzsche. But the idea that death leads to the absurd gives rise to another consideration, too, that there's a sense in which we expect our lives to add up to something. And as Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament tells us quite bluntly, this is the vanity of vanities. It doesn't. And what Sisyphus and Ecclesiastes both give us is a picture of life where we have all of our aspirations and ambitions, our joys and our achievements, but ultimately, in the end, it amounts to nothing. That's the absurd. There's another sense in which Camus takes as his target the whole of the scientific worldview, the idea of objectivity. The thesis basically is that it's only life, only one's personal experience, that really counts. He points, for example, to Galileo, a funny figure in the history of science, one of its great geniuses. But in terms of his turmoil and opposition to the church, about which a great deal has been written, Camus says, in a way, he did the obvious. He was justified. Given a choice between life and truth, the obvious choice is going to be life. What's more, science in general gives us a view, which one recent philosopher has called the view from nowhere. It's the idea of an impersonal, objective truth. I remember when I was in elementary school, on the bulletin board of my classroom, there was a picture of the solar system. And of this course made me very excited. But in retrospect, I now ask myself, from where was this picture depicted? What is the perspective? And the answer, I think, is from nowhere in particular. And when you look at this picture of the solar system, I remember as a little kid, someone would point to the third rock from the sun and say, that's us. And of course, even on a poster 6 feet wide, it was virtually a dot. And this vast expanse surrounding it. And even then, I remember the feeling, it makes you feel awfully small. And then, of course, I learned about galaxies. And now, of course, we have these marvelous photographs of our galaxy and galaxies beyond. And there's a sense in which, taking up this picture of the world, one feels infinitesimally insignificant. Or looking at the timeline of the universe, 15 billion years, of which, what, 9, 10 billion years, there's been some form of life. The dinosaurs, mere 165 million years ago. Human beings, depends exactly what you measure from, but a couple hundred thousand years. What we call history, at most 5,000 years. America, 200 years. My generation, 50 years. You look at a list, a timeline of the universe, and you feel, I feel so insignificant. I'm just a dot on a dot on a dot on a very small space. If you take a scientific worldview, of course, what you're supposed to do is take an objective view. You're supposed to, in a sense, erase yourself. Scientific papers always proceed, in this experiment, it is proven that, or something like that. It's not, I feel that such and such, because how you feel and who you are doesn't really matter, isn't supposed to matter. And yet Camus says, the only thing that matters, the only thing that is truly meaningful, is personal experience. There's another way he approaches the absurd, and of course, this fits the Sisyphus story quite nicely. We're rational, and part of what it means to be rational is that we ask the question, why? Sometimes this is a quest for an explanation, in science, for example. Sometimes it's a quest for a justification, for example, in ethics. But the interesting and upsetting thing about why-type questions, as anyone who has a three-year-old child knows all too well, is that the questions keep coming. Why is this? Here's an answer. Well, why is that? Here's an answer. And as any parent knows, the parent's knowledge gives in long before the child has finished with the whys. The truth is that this chain of reasoning, this chain of explanation, or in ethics, the chain of justification, has no final anchor. If you're thinking, for example, about why you do what you do, you might come up most of the time with an answer, if I do this, that'll help me get that. Why do you want that? If I get that, then that'll help me along to getting this. And the questions go on until finally you're driven to some endpoint, seemingly, where you say, well, because it gives me pleasure, or because it'll make me happy. And then, of course, the fatal question. What's important about pleasure? Why do you want to be happy? And you're stuck. And, of course, there are lots of philosophers, particularly in the Christian tradition, who have asked very seriously about why pleasure or happiness should be a final end. There's a sense in which justification runs out. So too in science. Understanding runs out. Understanding the universe, contrary to the view of a great many Enlightenment philosophers, will never ultimately give us satisfaction. Because the truth is, the absurd is with us. The absurd is this confrontation between our rational demands and the indifferent universe. And within that context, reason itself becomes a problem. Now, going back to the Sisyphus story itself, I think one should ask, how does Sisyphus cope with the absurd? Camus makes it very clear in his telling of the story that Sisyphus is what he calls the absurd hero. And while we might readily agree that his situation is absurd, what is it that makes him a hero? And looking back to the stranger, there's a very important question to ask. Does this notion of the absurd hero refer back to Merceau as well? Is he an absurd hero, or is he simply, as I said in the last lecture, not yet a human being? Well, the Sisyphus story might be interpreted in two different ways, and Camus gives us hints towards each. The first interpretation, which I think is very close to Camus' best thinking, is this. He says, in language which is a bit archaic and amusing now, that Sisyphus makes his rock his thing. He puts himself into his labor, and one can imagine Sisyphus, as he rolls the rock up the mountain, coming to notice, appreciate, and even love the various contours and markings on the rock itself. He comes to study and appreciate and even become very fond of the various bumps and levels that the rock has to proceed along. There's a sense in which what he does is he throws himself into his labor. And the consequence of this Camus tells us, is that Sisyphus must be considered happy. One thinks about being given a somewhat routine chore to do at the office or at home. And there's a way of doing it which is guaranteed to cause you a bad time. And that is, if you're always looking at your watch and seeing how much more you've got to go, or looking at the task itself and saying, oh, I'm only a third through. As you continue to reflect on what you're doing in an important sense is you undermine it. The reflection poisons the experience, going back to the stranger. There's a sense in which, insofar as we can simply get into what we do, make ourselves simply love it, every moment of it, love the process, even it might be painful or tedious in portions, to that extent, we live our lives to the fullest and we're happy. But what's interesting here is that the role of reflection, the role of reason, is a problem. Because insofar as that reflection simply has to do with asking yourself the question, what does this amount to? The answer is always going to be deeply unsatisfying. And you go back to Ecclesiastes again, it all amounts essentially to nothing. The second answer that Camus gives us is a bit more difficult to stomach. It's the idea that Sisyphus takes on his task because he has to, but he does it with resentment. He resents the gods who have so condemned him. And there's an irony here, of course, because Camus is an atheist and wants to ask what the gods are doing there. But the basic idea is that what keeps Sisyphus afloat, what keeps him feeling that his life is meaningful, is that he shakes his fist at the gods as he is doing his task with, as Camus tells us, scorn and defiance. In other words, resentment. One of the themes of Camus' philosophy, and in particular his political philosophy, is the theme of rebellion. Now, rebellion here is a very curious notion, because it's not full-fledged revolt in the sense that we typically think of it. With regard to the Algerian War, he was very clear that rebellion meant refusing to go along with the sides of cruelty. And so too in the years following the Second World War, when a good many of his colleagues were avid Marxists and communists, he said, to rebel is to refuse to go along with these sometimes very cruel policies. Sisyphus rebels, but what's interesting is he doesn't do what we would expect him to do as a member of his own labor union, and that is to drop the rock and refuse to push it any further. He continues to push the rock. It's his fate. But as he does it, he rebels in the sense that he refuses to accept the absurdity that has been imposed upon him by the gods. Now, there's a way of interpreting this, and Camus himself is prone to this interpretation in the novel we'll talk about in a couple of lectures called The Fall. It's also something that Nietzsche talks about at great length when he talks about the morals of resentment. But it is a reactive gesture. It is a way of giving meaning to your life, but in reaction, in rejection of something else. And I think this is a problem, and it is very much at odds with the more positive view that Camus presents of the value of life as life itself, the kind of picture that we get in the first solution to Sisyphus' problem when he simply throws himself into his work and says, this is what I do, and I'm not going to think about the fact that in the end of eternity, it's added up to nothing. The notion of rationality and reflection here refers on the one hand to consciousness. And I think it's important to realize that with Camus, before him with Kierkegaard, with some other figures we're going to talk about, Dostoevsky, consciousness is not a blessing. Consciousness is not necessarily an achievement. Consciousness is a problem. Camus says of Sisyphus, if his story is tragic, it's tragic because the hero is conscious. And here what he means is self-conscious, reflective. One can imagine, for example, one of those wasps that has a certain ritual, hardwired, checking its larva, coming up, checking its prey, going through a certain kind of ritual to which evil-minded biologists will sometimes move the prey a little bit and cause the wasp to repeat this performance indefinitely. One imagines a cockroach trying to get a raisin across the floor, but it keeps hitting a bump and rolling back down, and the cockroach does it again and again and again. Or one imagines a machine whose very nature is to perform the same movement over and over again. None of this is absurd. It only becomes absurd when there's a human being or some conscious creature involved who sees that this is repetition and it's futile. It's by contrast with the expectation that this will amount to something, that life is absurd. The notion of rationality also refers to intelligibility, the idea that we understand the universe. Now, as I said, Camus doesn't give a whole lot of attention to science, so it's not so much scientific explanation he's concerned with, so much as it's simply a matter of trying to understand why life is as it is, why things happen as they happen. And the truth is that that's just what our understanding won't allow us, because the universe is absurd, not just in the sense that it doesn't satisfy our moral demands, but it doesn't satisfy our demands for understanding either. Now, we're going to see these themes repeated in many different authors. They all, in fact, precede Camus. I mentioned Dostoevsky, and many of the theses I've just briefly rehearsed here are going to repeat themselves, particularly in his great novel, The Brothers Karamazov, in the character of Ivan, who is similarly concerned with the absurdity of the world, with the medieval problem of evil, the fact that things don't always work out the way we want them to work out. And Ivan, as a matter of fact, goes crazy trying to deal with this problem. But Sisyphus, by contrast, comes out, as Camus tells us, as a happy man. Which brings us back to Meursault in The Stranger. In what sense is he an absurd hero? Well, in the sense that he essentially puts himself into his life, is totally engaged in it, I think we could say he is much like the first solution to the Sisyphus problem, with the exception that with him there's no reflection, so there's no commitment. In a sense, there's no throwing yourself into your life. It's rather just being there. In a sense, does he rebel? Well, certainly not at all in the first part of the novel, where he rather easily gives in to any request that's made of him, simply the path of least resistance. Nevertheless, if we look at the last part of the novel, the act before the chaplain, when he bursts into anger and screams at the chaplain in no uncertain terms that he doesn't really give a damn about his God, his afterlife, and all the rest, that is, for Camus, an act of serious rebellion. And at the same time, when he comes up with the philosophy, which essentially maintains his innocence now reflectively in the face of the obvious fact of his legal and factual guilt, that too, I think, is an important sort of rebellion. And it's that rebellion which, according to Sisyphus, is what makes one the hero. But of course, I think the problem is deeper than this. Because when Meursault, in his reflective stage, in what passes for a kind of philosophical soliloquy, talks about the meaning of life as being just the living of life itself, and it not mattering how one lives or the quality of life, there's a sense in which what he comes up with is something which I think we find rather desperate. When someone talks about the passion for life, one could, of course, mean that this is a person who is enthusiastic about everything. Or in Sisyphus's case, one thinks this is a person who has thrown themselves into their projects, into their work. But at the same time, the idea of a passion for life can be a kind of desperate gesture. Nothing left to live for except for life itself. The paradox goes deeper than this, and one thinks about both Meursault and Sisyphus in this regard. There's a sense in which, when we ask about the meaning of life, what we want is a certain kind of answer. God has sometimes been thought to provide that. the future happiness of humanity, has sometimes been thought to provide it. But the truth of it is that either we find the meaning of life in our lives, or we're not going to find it at all. But where do we find it? The message we get from the stranger, and subsequently from the myth of Sisyphus, is that insofar as you are wholly engaged in your life and you taste the experience that you have, that is the meaning. But once you elevate yourself to a philosophical level and start reflecting and start asking yourself the question, what does it all amount to? What is its meaning? Then suddenly, you don't have an answer. What Mercer does in The Stranger is he takes this reflective rebellion and he turns it into an acceptance of exactly what he lived before, the experience as he lived it, and nothing more. It doesn't matter that it adds up to nothing. Sisyphus, on the other hand, as he reflects on the meaning of life, on the one hand, throws himself into his work, and that gives his life meaning. But on the other hand, he resents the gods who put him there. Or, in a purely secular way, we might say, one resents one's place in life, one's role, one's lot, one's fortune. But that's a very different sensibility. And I think one of the things we're going to get from Nietzsche is that that way of trying to give meaning to your life ultimately destroys itself. What we get in Camus is a very interesting perspective on our lives, in which the idea is not to look at our lives objectively, look at our lives from a distance. When we do that, when we detach ourselves from our own experience and engagements, the result is something which is utterly unsatisfactory. Camus gives the example, a nice little metaphor. If you're looking at someone inside a soundproof phone booth, yelling into the receiver, but you have no idea what the person's upset about or what the conversation is, and you can't hear a word, there's something incredibly absurd about the whole scene. Or Kierkegaard talks about watching another couple make love. And in the 19th century, of course, making love refers to very simple kissing and caressing, not to the more full-blown acts that we talk about today. But you watch a couple who are making love to each other, and there's a sense in which it looks ridiculous. It's only when you are the one that's engaged that it's meaningful. And so too, Camus wants to say, it's only insofar as we are fully engaged in our lives that life makes sense. But that, of course, raises an enormous question. What then is the role of reason and reflection? How should we live if what we're supposed to do is somehow take philosophical charge of our lives? Can we be like Mercer and come to an understanding in which we simply throw ourselves back into our lives or resign ourselves to our fates? And the attitude of most of the existentialists is, no, that's much too simple. But Camus himself realizes that's much too simple. And in the next two novels we talk about, we're going to see a very different set of problems present themselves.